Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. All right, up the back there. Do I need to make it louder? Good. All right. Well, it's 10 a.m. on the dot, and it looks like we've got a fair turnout, so it might be time to get this thing underway. So you got your 5-second warning there, guys. Good to go. All right, so good morning, everyone. It's good to be here. It's the third year I'm at BSD Cannes, and this year I'm doing something a little different. So the past 2 years I've been talking about what I do with FreeBSD, and this time I thought it'd be interesting to talk about how I do it. In a lot of respects, that's kind of evolved over the course of about the last 2 years since I became sort of a committer, granted a commit bit, and started figuring out that the way I was doing things perhaps wasn't as efficient, as useful, and giving me the best bang for my buck in terms of time spent developing on FreeBSD. So developers are really good at figuring things out, setting themselves up with, you know, beautiful little tweaks, scripts, hacks, whatever, to get the job done better, faster, quicker. But we're not so good at documenting these things. So what I've tried to do is, I guess, collate little bits of information that I've pulled from conversations on IRC, from various websites scattered throughout the internet, into a single place, I guess, to give people that are perhaps interested in getting involved in kernel development a place to start or a place to move on from. So that's basically the sort of premise here. So there's a fairly broad range of topics to cover, so it's going to be more a breadth rather than depth talk. And I wanted to give you guys a chance to leave the room now if you perhaps already well-versed in all of this. I'm not going to be offended if anyone walks out realizing that they kind of have most of what I'm going to say under their belt already. So who am I? Why am I here talking to you? Basically, I'm a telecommunications engineer by sort of trade. I've been developing on FreeBSD for the last couple of years and been using for not many more. Since about 2003, and I use it as in my capacity as a researcher at a university, and to do all sorts of weird and wonderful things, particularly to the TCP stack is my particular area of interest. And I'm doing a PhD in transport protocols, so that's kind of part of the motivation for a lot of the work I do with FreeBSD. So before we get started, I kind of want to just set the scene in terms of manage people's expectations. This isn't going to be a real deep dive into all the topics. It's really about kind of making people aware of what are some of the various options you have and the various tools you can use, and not really go into the depths of how to use them, but at least point you to them so you can then start going and looking at man pages and, you know, various other bits of documentation. So it really is fairly high level. And I do want to provide a fairly significant caveat that I haven't used some of the stuff I'm going to talk about personally, so it's more sort of secondhand information that I'm trying to convey. And I do hope to get around to using it at some point, but the point is that I'm not an expert on all the material, and I am very happy and, in fact, grateful to accept information, corrections, contributions from anyone in the audience. So I'm happy to do this interactively. So if you've got a concern, an addition or whatever, feel free to raise your hand during the talk and we can keep it a bit more like a dialogue. So yeah, anyone, I know there are a lot of very experienced people in this room looking around, so I'm happy to accept feedback either today or offline as well via email or IRC or whatever. And my kind of goal is eventually to start incorporating some of this stuff into the more official documentation sources, perhaps like the FreeBSD Developer Handbook, just so that people casually browsing the web can find it in one nice, simple, easy-to-find place. That's really kind of what I'm hoping to do. And there's an actual paper I'm working on behind the scenes. It's going to be sort of published as a technical report for my research center, and that's kind of what I'm hoping will form the basis for some of the contribution to the project's documentation. So without further ado, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the hardware considerations that you might want to think about if you were thinking about doing some kernel development. This might be all fairly obvious to some people, but it's good to have at least a rule of thumb in the back of your mind for sort of generic sort of stuff. So, and I'm kind of going on what I've currently got set up at work. So there are obviously a myriad of permutations, but this is really just to kind of give you at least an initial starting point. So the sort of first key piece of hardware to speak of is the development server. So this is a machine that basically is going to form the sort of day-to-day hub for all your FreeBSD development, kernel development work. The idea is that you have a single workspace which you work in, you keep it up all the time, you maintain all the various source trees you're working on with the various patches you're working on. This machine is also going to provide the services and the builds that you're going to actually run on a separate test machine. So the idea is to decouple the act of developing source code and testing source code from the act of actually testing it, running it, and trying to debug it. There's nothing more frustrating, and I went through this for a number of months, where you develop a change on a machine, and then you run that kernel, and then you have to reboot when you crash it, and losing all of your editor state, all of the various sysctl settings you had set, all these sort of things that you sort of do on the fly while you're in the process of doing your testing work. So in terms of the hardware considerations for the development server, basically the kind of commodity hardware now has got to the point where it's pretty easy to get something that's quite useful for this. So personally, I run AMD 64 hardware, and it's useful to have it availability of the virtualization extensions. And I'll talk about that a bit more detail a bit later on. And having at least two cores really kind of helps speed up the builds. So I kind of like to go for less cores at a higher clock rate than lots of cores at a lower clock rate, but that's kind of personal preference. So for networking work, having the higher clock speeds is actually more useful than having lots of slower cores. But as I said, this is all kind of dependent on the tasks you're doing. But the disk subsystem gets a pretty heavy workout, particularly with doing SVN work, and our tree's got quite a lot of files in it. So in sort of order of preference, if you can actually afford them, SSDs are kind of a fairly major game changer in this respect. So they obviously have orders of magnitude lower seek latencies, and they're really, really nice for the sort of random I/O workloads that are typically going on, compiling, checking out source code, manipulating SVN trees and whatnot. Scaling down from that, what I actually have in my dev server at work are two 10K Western Digital Raptor drives. They're just a regular SATA drive, 2.5-inch form factor, but in a 3.5-inch caddy, so you can stick them in a regular PC case. And I've got them, rated, mirrored. And the 10K RPM gives you obviously lower rotational latencies, which you can actually notice when you're you're doing work. It's a substantial speed up compared to, say, a regular 7200 RPM SATA disk. And if you can't afford those, the kind of lowest option that is still reasonably good is to actually just RAID 0 a couple of bog standard SATA drives. Obviously, the more you get in RAID, the better throughput you're going to get. But you've got a redundancy there, so there are some options. Having a decent amount of RAM really helps. So if you're running ZFS, it's a fairly greedy file system, and by having a fair bit of RAM, it allows the ARC to store a whole heap of stuff, which further reduces, once you've primed the cache, it further reduces the amount of time you're sitting there twiddling your thumbs while you're waiting for things to happen. So that's kind of useful. And also the FreeBSD buffer cache, obviously, is going to... And there are another number of other subsystems, but those are the two kind of key ones that are going to benefit from having a reasonable amount of RAM floating around in the machine. Having two NICs is kind of useful. So I run my dev server with a public-facing NIC to the university network, and I also have a secondary NIC, which is a private network between it and the test servers that I have sitting behind them. So the idea is that you kind of effectively isolate your test machines from the production network, which is generally a good thing, particularly when you're trying to run experimental code and you don't want to upset people too much. So having the separate NICs, you can also do it with VLANs or other options, but this is pretty idiot-proof and you're unlikely to screw things up. Dual serial ports is really important. I typically, to save myself a bit of pain, use a single one for the serial console of the test machine and then the other one to do kernel debugging on, so you don't have to flip around and mess around in software when you're trying to switch between console and serial debugging. So that's kind of a useful thing. on the dev server using the USB to serial adapters to get more serial ports if they don't have them on board is perfectly fine and useful. FireWire is not something I've used. I've got the hardware and haven't actually set it up, but I hear that you can do very, very cool things with it. Like, for example, on the dev server, still access the memory of the target test system even when the machine's fully crashed. But I heard a rumor that it may only be 32-bit. Does anyone know if that's true? Can you access a full 64-bit address space on...
Yeah? I think it's limited to the lower 32 bits as far as the physical address. The FireWire stuff on the physical domain, I think the FireWire controller can only address 4 gigs of physical address.
Okay, so it can only address the first 4 gigs of physical address. Yeah. Okay. Some of the 800, FireWire 800, 64-bit. Okay. So that's kind of interesting to know.
That's pretty rare, and we don't have support for that right now. But for 32-bit stuff, this works great.
Okay.
It's faster than anything else.
Okay. And can you debug a 64-bit kernel, just the lower 4 gig worth of RAM with a...
I haven't tried that.
Okay. So there could be demons and skeletons lurking there. But if you're debugging i386 at least, this is kind of a cool way and a fast way to get access to the target memory, the memory of the test system that you're trying to debug. So I find that low-end server boards are actually really good for this. They're fairly cheap, you know, about 300 Australian bucks gets you an entry-level Intel board which has, you know, all the features and more for doing this sort of work. So that's kind of why I mentioned there as an initial point. Okay, so you've got your development server. Now what the hell are you going to test your code on? You can have one or more. I've only got one at work. I keep it pretty simple. But basically, the idea of this system, it's the thing that's going to be executing your custom kernels, the patches that you're testing. It's the thing that you're going to be actually executing code on. It's going to be the thing that you're actually running, say, KGDB against in order to get your debugging information out. And it'll probably provide crash dump storage because you typically dump core to a swap partition on the physical machine, so you're likely going to want to have some disk space in there to actually handle dumping of cores for offline analysis. And the nice thing is that with with at least some of the tools that I'm going to be talking about a bit later, you manage to keep it mostly stateless. So if this thing blows up on any given day, it really doesn't matter. You just find another machine off the scrap heap, plug it in, and you're off because all of your state, all your interesting work is actually being maintained on your development server. And having these fast to start up is also useful. So similar sort of deal, and obviously dependent on what you're developing once again, but having an SMP system that can do AMD64, so you can actually run i386 or AMD64 on the machine, gives you a little more coverage there. I've just got bog standard hard drives, at least a gig of RAM. You need Pixie and your NIC in order to do Pixie booting, which I'm going to talk about in a bit. So that's obviously fairly key. Dual serial ports, again, are useful, but you really can't use, or at least I haven't figured out how to use USB to serial usefully here because we don't actually support, or at least I haven't been able to make it work, USB to serial adapters when you actually panic the kernel. So they don't seem to be useful.
There's no support for that whatsoever.
Sorry?
There's no support for that whatsoever.
There's no support for that whatsoever. Okay, that's what I thought.
USB stack knows about panics.
Right, right.
I
did see polling support go in at some point, which my understanding was that was kind of the prerequisite for having it work in sort of DDB mode. But that's about all I know on that. So I've just got a machine off the heap at work, you know, a spare old piece of crap that's like a Pentium 4 with hyperthreading, so that gives me my two cores. Not particularly useful, but it works. So remote access, it's kind of annoying when you're on the other side of the planet and your box goes down. So getting something set up that allows you to, say, power cycle and maintain things is useful. And thankfully, there are a number of solutions now, some of them easier to come by than others. IPMI is something that I've never used, but I actually learned about last night thanks to Doug and Robert Watson, so that you can actually apparently just load a kernel module, install a port, and assuming your board's got the IPMI hardware on it, a BMC, I believe, the necessary bit is called. It basically provides a completely offline interface to the machine so that you can, even if the host OS is down, you can log in, restart things, and recover from badness, general badness. Most servers now ship with integrated lights out, and you can buy them as separate cards, or they come integrated in the server. A little more pricey, but pretty cool. You've kind of got a web interface, you've got a command line interface, and you can do all sorts of interesting things there. You get console redirection. IP KVMs are also an option, expensive, but basically give you remote control of the keyboard, video, and mouse, which is exactly what they do. So then you've got things like that just do power, remote power. So we've got some of those in the FreeBSD NetPerf cluster, for example. You basically telnet into this device and say, power cycle this port, and it basically physically cuts, opens a relay, cuts power to the box. And you can buy them from companies like APC and the like. And there are dedicated console servers to provide you with console access. You know, it mucks up 24 ports of serial or whatever into a single box. That's fairly common. And there's a company actually that was at the developer summit. Sorry, George.
So the power management strips, you're going to mention Exatrols if they run FreeBSD?
You're 2 seconds ahead of me. So company at the FreeBSD developer summit called Exatrol, who actually develop an embedded FreeBSD product. It's an all-in-one console power management device. I was lucky to get my hands on one of these last year, and they're extremely sweet. And they run FreeBSD, which is cool. And the gentleman who is developing it, David Sharp, has come to the last two BSD cans, so it's all last two dev summits at least. And they're a very impressive unit, but it's all a trade-off. And if you're living on the student budget like I have been, I want to talk a little bit about this homebrew option, which actually kind of works reasonably well, and I've still actually got it running because I haven't swapped it out for my my Exatrol box yet. So this idea actually came from... Warner?
Another idea, before you get too deeply into this, at Christmas time, a lot of places, at least in the U.S., remote control, light, radio control light plugs. And they work really well if you're dealing with embedded boards as well. They're cheap on clearance right after Christmas. They're like $5 and you get 3 or 4 ports.
Radio controlled light plug. So what and what do you use to press the button, as it were?
You just press a button, or you.
When you're in Japan, you're.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So you've got to be within the same vicinity.
This is the lazy man way. Oh, it's across the aisle.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you have port, embedded ports on it. You can turn them off remotely.
Right. And do you know what the range is on that RF?
About 100 yards, 100 meters.
100 yards or meters? Are they the same?
Yeah.
Close enough. Okay. You people that don't use metric. Okay, that's kind of cool. I haven't seen that. If you could actually shoot me a link or something, that would be cool. Yeah, so a friend of mine, I'm not an electronics guy, really, but I do like to paint solder onto something every now and again. He came up with this idea, so I can't take any credit for it. It's all his. But Warren's idea, basically, and it's not a new idea by any means, but he actually drew it up for me, is to basically take an old parallel cable, chop the female end off. There's 8 data lines and a whole lot of other cruft in there, and pull out the 8 data lines, the strobe pin, and using that fairly simple circuit diagram with a transistor and a couple of resistors, and don't ask me off the top of my head what those values are, I need to look them up, but it's 4.7K, thank you. That sounds about right. I knew it was something like 3K or 4K, somewhere in that range. And basically what that allows you to do is with a little piece of software, which I've got the link to there, the pushthebutton.c, I've stuck that online for everyone. It basically allows you to flip one of the bits on the parallel port, and you can control up to technically 8 of these things. It's not ideal. We had an idea to do a slightly better version of this using a capacitor to debounce the input signal, because the problem was if you restart the machine that's controlling the parallel port during startup, it kind of flips bits all over the place, and of course your test machine gets trashed as a result. So it's and doing some optocoupling in order to avoid the ground problems between, say, one machine and the other. It hasn't been a problem for me, but it would be nicer to do it that way. Yeah. Okay.
Back in the 70s or 80s, it's like one bit for every zero crossing of the 60 hertz AC.
Right.
And the appliance plugs go on eBay under $10. They're really cheap, especially in quantity. And what you want to get is a telephone remote, which is something that will control up to, I think, 16 or 256, depending on how you configure it, of these appliance plugs. And you can basically turn them off and on remotely.
Okay. And you said $10 or $100?
Well, it's about $10 for the appliance.
$10.
And the remote controls again.
Yeah.
Who's going to want to watch eBay for X10 for garbage? Not
X10, E as in X and the number 10?
Letter
X-10. Okay.
Sometimes home automation.
Okay, home automation.
On the used market, I've seen a lot of people use these in the ghetto colo sense in that you can phone line and you can control a number of these with the caveat that they have to be on the same phase as the controller. So
right, right. Yeah. Yeah. Ghetto colo, I like that. I've heard that term used before. Okay, cool. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on it too much. There are obviously lots of cool options. That's kind of the finished product. It's not very good, but you get the sort of idea. So I just put it out in a little box and with a bit of biscuit board or whatever and literally twisted and painted some solder over it with my excellent soldering skills. But it works, and I've just got a machine running that. So for the students watching at home. There's supposed to be an image in here, but I haven't got around to creating it, so that will be up on the version that I put up online. But basically, I wanted to talk quickly about the fact that the FreeBSD project, particularly sponsored by many of the people that provide us with equipment and whatnot, we have a pretty awesome cluster. And for anyone that doesn't have facilities to do some of the more, complicated or on architectures that perhaps they don't have easy access to, the cluster provides a whole lot of equipment for you to be able to do work. So you do need to be a developer with a commit bit in order to get access to it. But there's 10 gig networking gear in there. There's switches. It's all VLAN capable, so you can build arbitrary topologies on the back end connecting machines. I believe there's some very large SMP MIPS systems. There's x86 stuff in there. So it's those two wiki links provide most of the information any of you will need to know if you need to use it. I've used it once, and the setup's reasonably good. And with some of the additions in terms of console and power management, I believe it's getting easy to use sort of by the day. So, definitely worth keeping in the back of your mind if you need to. If you don't have the resources to do some, say, larger scale testing, or you don't have 10 gig kit like I don't, it's extremely useful. So I have physical hardware, but obviously with availability of virtualization solutions, it's kind of an interesting idea now to perhaps not use as much hardware and take advantage of multiple cores running on a single machine, and perhaps decouple your development server and your test server, but logically on the same machine, not actually have separate physical hardware. And you can do this now relatively easily. So in terms of stuff that you can actually run natively on FreeBSD, I'm sure you're familiar with all those options. VImage isn't full virtualization, so it's more if you're trying to do, networking stack related work where having a single kernel but multiple instances of the network stack is useful. That's actually a really good option. But if you need full virtualization, VirtualBox and QEMU do the job. And obviously there's Xen, VMware, and I'm sure I've forgotten some other ones. So the file system snapshot rollback that you get with the full virtualization solutions like QEMU and VirtualBox are extremely useful. It basically avoids foot shooting. So before you're about to do something kind of scary, or you're likely to do something that'll scribble over your UFS partition, you can take a snapshot, do your worst, and then roll back if things go pear-shaped, or if things don't, you can carry on. So that's an extremely useful way to get yourself out of trouble. You can actually tie virtual serial ports in the virtual machines back to the host machine, so you can effectively get the same benefit of having, you know, two serial ports, one for serial console, one for remote debugging, without actually having physical ports in use. And the one I've been trying to get working recently and haven't had much success with is Pixie booting a VirtualBox image, for example, and having it mount NFS from the host machine into the image. There's a problem with our Pixie bootloader at the moment that means it doesn't actually work in VirtualBox. But I have had reports that it does work, so I'm still trying to get to the bottom of that. But if anyone knows about that, please come talk to me afterwards. There are a couple of problems with virtualization, though. It's not good for everything. The timing, I think we heard someone at the Developer Summit talk about it a bit, but the timing is really bad inside full virtualization options, and except for VImage, which is running in the single kernel and not having any hypervisor messing with things. So you've got to be really careful if you're doing anything that is sort of time-dependent or time-sensitive, particularly if you're taking measurements and trying to claim that they're representative of something. You've got to be very, very careful there. And, of course, you've got additional contention to host resources, so you can get wide variances in measurements from, you know, from one step to the next. So, yeah, question?
Question about the virtual CA port support.
VirtualBox support?
No, the virtual
CA port
support.
Oh, virtual CA ports, yep. Can you do it under VMware? Yes. Okay, so I have very minimal experience with FreeBSD under VMware other than running it as a regular host. I haven't done debugging with it. But so the question was, are there GDB scripts to...
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can run GDB on your MacBook Pro.
Right.
So you can run GDB on your MacBook Pro and break it to the kernel of the guest FreeBSD and get a listing of the threads.
Uh-huh.
You only get a listing of the threads that are on the virtual CPU currently.
At Esalen, we run VMware virtual lines all the time. We typically host it online. But we also found that the features from GDB, like
Huh.
So, like,
handy.
Like, we're essentially cross compiling a version. GDB has target support for FreeBSD, but in between GDB versions, some versions will work for info threads, some versions will work for one thing, some versions will work for another thing. Like, some of us have two different GDBs, so just to solve this problem.
All right, let's take this offline, guys, because I've got to keep moving. Sorry. No, that's okay. We can talk more later. Anyway, so I've got to keep moving. Okay, revision control. So FreeBSD was running CVS, has switched to using Subversion for development. First thing, always use the FreeBSD specific Subversion port when you're working with, or even likely to be working with FreeBSD Subversion sources. It doesn't hurt to have the FreeBSD Subversion client installed a lot and use it on non-FreeBSD code unless you've got $FreeBSD in it. It's not going to do anything bad. So I've put a copy of a Subversion config. Most people forget to set up their auto props. It's something that you should all do on your systems before you start developing code, because often you don't remember to set various bits. I think the pre-commit script checks for some things, but it's still worth doing the first time. So if you want to have a look at one that's already set up, I've stuck it on my Freefall account. So you use SVN over SSH in order to access the Subversion repository. It's useful to use SSH agent if you don't know what that is or how to use it. It's very, very simple to set up. And I've got a couple of little notes and a couple of little useful bit of shell RC line that you can stick in your shell. I use TCSH, so it's only for C shells, but it takes some of the work out of having to remember to set all the various... The two environment variables that you need. Sorry, it's only one environment variable. just a bit of commentary on the branching. Basically, slash projects is for things that are being developed to go into head, stuff that's supposed to go into slash user, and this is sort of regurgitating what Peter Wem, who did the conversion for us, kind of wanted to see happen. Stuff that's more speculative, perhaps is useful to the wider community, should be publicly available, but we're not sure it's necessarily going to be merged back in. Stick that under your slash user branch, and it's and away you go. So it's there's some usage examples there, but more for offline. It is kind of problematic, though, for people that aren't committers. So, you know, Subversion is locked down to provide access control to only people who've been explicitly granted it. And it's kind of difficult to do offline development with it. So, and not to mention the fact that, if you're maintaining it. So, for example, the USB stack is one of the more recent examples. You know, we've got someone who developed it who wasn't a FreeBSD committer and still isn't, as far as I'm aware. So he's got to use something else. So we have other alternatives available. Perforce has been in use for a very, very long time, and a lot of people have been around a while know and love it very dearly. It's still a centralized management system. It's really good at merging, so it's nice for doing long-lived project branches, managing them. The big problem with it, to my mind, is the fact that it's kind of low visibility. It's very hard to direct people that don't have Perforce accounts to it to get, you know, copies of branches and whatever. I know it can be done, but it's certainly less visible in that respect. It's still centralized. You can't do offline development with it. So I would argue, and this is my personal opinion, I would argue that it doesn't provide a great deal of benefit over Subversion other than the merging capabilities. So with relatively recent, I guess not that recent, but the rise of the distributed version control systems is upon us. And I've recently, about a month ago, started looking into the various options that are around. And I did I spent about 3 days kind of figuring out what was around, what was good, and how we could use it. My thoughts are currently that we should be using them to augment Subversion and not replace it. The one thing they don't do very well is providing a consistent version number for files that our end users can use to very easily figure out, do they have revision blah, which includes all the changes before it. With Subversion, you've got a monotonically increasing ID. Very, very simple to figure out. With some of these other options, you've got, you know, SHA-1 hashes of data, which is kind of not particularly useful. And if you know how to use the tools, you can get around that, but it's I personally don't think they're particularly good in that respect. I feel that we should be running them alongside Perforce, and that perhaps eventually we should try and think about using it as the primary place where we do long-lived project branch development. And not only that, it really simplifies life for non-committers. So anyone can clone a copy of the repository, develop and keep revision control history for themselves in their own private repositories, and then publish patches back to the project very, very easily. And not in other cases. So it really makes doing third-party vendor sort of management easy. So, for example, in my research center, we do a lot of development against FreeBSD. I was originally having to actually import the FreeBSD sources as a vendor branch into our own private Subversion repository, and then from there branch off that internally. Creating patches to put back upstream was a real nightmare using that.
Quickly to mention, there's very powerful SVN to Git translators.
Yeah, right. So a lot of these tools provide options to convert from and to all the various options. Yeah, Warner. Yeah.
That would be the official seed from the project.
Yes.
That people could then, you know, collaborate on via GitHub or what have you.
Yep. So I would be really supportive of that. Whether, you know, as I say here, I think it boils down to only those two choices in my opinion. The research I did, that was kind of what it came down to. I ended up actually choosing Mercurial. I've got a fairly, I've got a set of reasons for that. I've had a chat with Ulrich. So he gave a talk at the Developer Summit about using Git, and it'd be interesting to kind of figure out whether we should be picking one or provide seeds for both, and there should be a discussion about it, but I think we should be providing at least one, and that's really going to lower the barrier to entry for people getting involved. And definitely I think there could be some interesting applications in terms of managing the ports tree, because the big argument against using Subversion for the ports tree is the fact that you get .svn states scattered throughout the port tree. There's a lot of directories in there, and that makes people kind of scared. So the nice thing about these options is they don't litter the tree with all this extra state. So it's pretty low impact in that respect. But obviously down the track, I'm not really saying for or against, but I think it'd certainly be interesting. Okay, so I didn't want to get too involved in a major flame war here. I didn't bring my asbestos underpants. So all I want to say is pick... Oh, yeah. Okay, well, I do use Vim. And the only reason I use Vim is because it was what the guy at work was using, and he could help me when I got stuck. So the only thing I will say is that pick one and learn it well. Don't become a jack of all trades, master of none in this respect. I think you're going to do yourself a disservice there. So pick one, learn how to use it. Robert's got a fantastic web-based index of not just FreeBSD sources, but all the other BSDs and even Linux in there, fxr.watson.org. If you haven't seen it before, have a look, and it's just all, it's like a modified version of LXR, and you can just kind of click through, follow code really, really nicely, and it's fantastic and very, very well worth using if you've obviously got a browser handy. Ken?
The FXR thing is great if you've got the net access.
Yeah. Tag support, yeah.
So if you're in a kernel build directory, you can say make tags, and after that, if you do vi-t and make the name, it will find it for you.
So what's the difference between tags and something like Cscope?
Cscope is vastly
more. Right. Cscope is more functional. Okay. Okay. Cool. Okay. I should add that in then. Okay, so for the people listening at home, the comment was that you can use C tags. Is that what it's called?
Just in a kernel build directory,
kernel build.
Make tags.
Okay, kernel build directory. You can type make tags and then vim -t,
and the function name,
and it'll go find it for you. Okay, cool. So yeah, learning your way around Cscope or tags is obviously going to cut down your grepping time. Because I was doing that for the longest while, and when I finally got introduced to Cscope and actually figured out how to get the muscle memory to remember the commands, it's extremely useful. I believe Emacs has similar and probably even vastly more integrated support. I don't know, but it works great. And I've also recently been told that Glimpse is faster for doing text-based searches. So Cscope is capable of doing things like, so the CSFG TCPCB looks for the definition of the anything called TCPCB. But if you're doing just to say the equivalent of a grep through the database, which you can do with a different sequence of commands, I believe Glimpse, and I haven't tested it, but I believe Glimpse is faster in that. And there's also support in the user source sys to actually just go and type make Glimpse, assuming you've got Glimpse installed, and it'll build a database. And I have no idea what key sequences and all that, but we're all smart people, we'll figure it out. Okay, so configuration. What sort of things do you need to kind of set up to pull this all together into something that's kind of coherent and useful? So the FreeBSD build system is actually kind of nice and makes sure I don't, and most of us don't, have to ever figure out make files and all build glue and all that, because some lovely people take care of that for us. So there are a couple of really useful targets that you're going to kind of run into in day-to-day development. These are all relative to the top-level make file sitting in user source or wherever your source tree is rooted at. Build world's fairly obvious, build kernel. Universe builds everything on all architectures. Make distribution is something that you can use typically when you're seeding a new directory hierarchy for doing like a PXE boot base file system. Make distribution kind of fills in all the bits in /etc and whatnot that don't get installed as part of the install world and whatnot. Cleandir is kind of the canonical target for actually removing all of the build cruft, including object files and all the symlinks and all that get set up. Buildenv was something I only found out about at about 1 a.m. this morning. So my understanding is that you can use it particularly when you're doing cross-compiling. So you can do make, set the target arc to the platform, and then buildenv that dumps you into a shell that has all the paths set up to use the cross-compiler and all the cross-compile tools and the tool chain for that. Did I kind of get that right?
Exactly.
Exactly. Excellent. Okay. So never use it myself. One day I hope to be able to do some work with other architectures, but it's there, and for anyone doing building for MIPS and ARM and all the other various things, apparently it's extremely useful. And of course, there's make delete old and make delete old libs, which you typically run after having done integration of a new world and want to clean out any cruft that's been deprecated or whatnot or moved around. So, in addition,
make delete old libs.
Sorry.
Make sure that all of your ports are updated.
Yeah. Update all your ports before doing make delete old libs. Yeah. So when you go from one major release to the next. Some of the libraries will get bumped, and if your ports are linked against the old library and you pull them out from under the feet, things get very cranky very quickly. you've experienced this before, just like I have. So, something to keep in mind. Excuse me. So in addition to that, there are some very, very useful make options that you couple with these various make targets in order to kind of make things quicker and easier for you. Destir is very, very commonly used in this scenario. So instead of installing to slash, relative to slash, if you're building a tree under a particular directory point somewhere in the file system, you set destir equals to that path, and then it'll install everything relative to that. So we use it extensively. No clean basically says don't flush all the object files out, which is obviously useful if you're doing incremental builds. Vastly speeds things up. Warner, I think, added kernfast, which is a kind of an amalgamation of a couple of these defines into something more useful. So it's like it's a no clean, no depend, and something else.
I forget all the words, yeah. But basically, if you build the kernel once,
yep.
Build kernel with kernfast, if you build it with kernfast, it just builds the kernel and all
right.
That other stuff I always forget to add.
Yep. If you change dependencies, though, it will sometimes fail, and then you've got to drop back to doing a dash D no underscore clean or whatever. But it's often good to try it first because it's so quick that if it works, it'll save you time, and if it doesn't, you've kind of just...
One gotcha is if you change the config file and then run a kernfast, it doesn't get picked up because it doesn't deal with the config.
Right.
And it doesn't tell you that you need to.
Right, okay. There you go. Gotcha for everyone. Make obj prefix where to stick the object files. You may want to tweak that depending on things. Setting the kernel config on the line. You can use kernconf to do that. Very simple. And if you're only interested in changing the kernel and don't actually need any modules, you can add dash d no underscore modules, and that really speeds things up when you don't have to chew through all the various module directories. So you want to bootstrap a directory with basically an entire base system distribution in order to pixie boot off it. This is kind of the series of steps. CDD is source tree, build world, build kernel, create a directory hierarchy in which you're going to install all of everything, install world into there, install your kernel in there, do a make distribution in there, run merge master with a couple of extra switches in order to tell it to pull from your source tree's concept of all the mtree files and whatnot, and push do the merge into the pixie boot directory. You want to set up your various serial ports. I've had no troubles running them at 115,000 baud, so I recommend doing it. It vastly speeds things up. And you want to set one of the ports, you want to set the flag to make it a debugging port so that you can KGDB will happily attach to it and work for you. And then assuming you've compiled your pixie boot correctly, you want to stick in your loader.conf file com console and vid console, which means output both to the serial console and to screen, so that if you don't have a screen, it's not really worth it. But I have a KVM on my desk, so I can use the serial console when I need to, but also it's actually outputting the VGA port when you need to. Enable the serial console using TTYU under the new parlance. And set your FS tab such that, and here it's kind of flexible, so you can mount root off NFS, you can have root local and just pull the kernel in over NFS. I use a mix of all three, and I've got an example FS tab file from one of my setups where I think I mount root from NFS. I've got memory file systems for, you know, /temp and a few other things. And I've got swap off a local hard drive on the test machine. So obviously, depending on need. So once you've bootstrapped your environment, it's pretty simple then to do changes. So, you know, you hack your kernel tree a little bit, you go back in, you do a make with kernfast first up, set your kernel conf if you're not using generic, and then you install the kernel and then reboot your test system, and that's it. Compared to having to do all that on the test machine, which is what I was doing previously, and then rebooting, and you know, that's a vastly simpler setup. And if you do make dependency changes, and there's kind of, I don't know the hard and fast rules here, but basically if kernfast fails, it's likely because you've added new dependencies in terms of header files or between modules and whatever. In that case, you want to fall back to dry -d no underscore clean, which will generally get you out of any grief. And if that still fails, then you omit the -d no clean, and it basically does a full rebuild from scratch. And assuming you haven't got you haven't added errors, it should go through. So, why netbooting? Kind of self-explanatory, but it really does quicken the development cycle from changing a line, rebuilding the kernel, running it. You can get it down to under a minute, as opposed to multiple minutes, mucking about trying to get things back up and running and whatever. So the basic idea, your test server uses Pixieboot, mounts, at least loads the kernel over NFS. You can obviously load other file systems. And you can also, use it to cross-compile, so you can build on your AMD64 server for a MIPS or an ARM platform and Pixieboot off that, Pixieboot the ARM compiled image, and it makes sure that most of the state is sitting on the development server in one nice place that's easy to back up and easy to work with. So the key steps, you've got to set up TFTP in order to be able to load the Pixieboot image. So steps there are pretty self-explanatory. Once you've got a Pixieboot file accessible, so you can test it using the TFTP protocol locally just to see that you can actually pull the Pixieboot binary. You set up your DHCP server basically to hand back the name of the IP address of the server that holds the TFTP Pixieboot file. You pass back the name of the file, and you pass back the root path, which is what it's going to use to mount root if you're mounting over NFS.
One note.
Yep.
Unless you're running currents, you probably need to install the FreeBSD TFTP D port because a lot of embedded machines aren't happy with FreeBSD's TFTP server.
Okay, for embedded work. Okay, so just to repeat for the recording, embedded platforms don't like FreeBSD's default TFTP server, so install the one from ports. Sounds good.
Yeah, there's like four different ones in ports, and any of them should work.
Any of them should work, okay. Well, I'm glad there are four TFTP servers in ports. It makes me happy. And then the last step is to get NFS actually working. And it's slightly involved process. When I eventually get the paper actually finished, there'll be kind of the blow-by-blow, step-by-step guide to do it. But the basic bits are, get RPC bind working, get mount D working, all the NFS server bits, and set your exports. You typically want with -all dir so that you can mount at any point below the root of the NFS tree. So typically I set my NFS tree to the directory that has my PXE base in it, and then under PXE base I have all the various trees for the various projects I'm working on. So I have one for my congestion control work and one for my ALQ work and whatever. So that's kind of useful. And on the test server, it's very simple. You enable Pixie booting in the BIOS, and if you're not mounting root over NFS, you need to set, either by breaking to the loader prompt or setting it I'm not sure how else you can set it. I know you can set it if you break to the loader prompt. You just set the VFS root mount from and say mount off the local disk, because by default Pixieboot will assume you want to pull over NFS. All right, so the last bit. Excuse me. Testing and debugging. These could involve multiple talks in their own right, so once again, just really trying to give a really high-level view and an idea of what's out there. So in terms of what you can actually stick in your kernel to help you in this regard, there are a wide number of options, all very, very useful in their own right. This isn't an exhaustive list, but particularly if you're running head, you'll have the first few already in your kernel. So invariants and invariant support basically add support for all the k-asserts that are scattered throughout the code. If you don't have invariants in there, they effectively get compiled out of the code. If you enable invariants, all of a sudden all those extra assertions and sanity checks get enabled. So when you're trying to debug something, enabling those options is extremely important. And if you're writing code, using k-asserts in your code is a low-impact way of sanity checking state and whatnot at the point you're running that. Witness is our lock. How do I describe it? I don't know what to call it. Someone help me out here. What does witness do? It's like a lock order.
Enforces
one true locker, thank you. And it does it dynamically. So it's able to check if locks are taken in the correct order, which can be defined in your code, and make sure that weird things aren't going. So if you ever run head and you see those lock order reversals that pop up, that's basically witness doing its job, telling you that it thinks there's a potential that there could be a deadlock, right? So the idea is if you're taking locks out of order and you don't know what you're doing, one thread could take the lock and that the other one's waiting, and they've both got locks each other's waiting on. So it's trying to resolve that. I believe recently there's been a deadlock resolution manager added. I don't know anything about it other than that it exists and it's able to detect, or supposed to detect, if deadlocks have happened or are likely to happen. Maybe have happened. I'll leave that one to the jury. KDB, DDDB, DDB and GDB, DDB adds the in-kernel debugger, which is integrated as part of the kernel, and GDB adds support for effectively doing remote KGDB. So typically you want all of those in there, and KDB enables those options, is a prerequisite. KTR and KTRLQ, Ktrace, there's a man page for it, but basically it provides sort of a fairly compact and low-impact way, relatively low-impact way of tracing what's going on in the kernel, and then you can post-process the output. It puts out like a binary format or whatnot. ALQ is something that I've actually been working on recently, and the reason I bring it up is because I didn't actually know about it when I started reinventing the wheel at one point. And it's extremely useful. So you can do basically logging to vnodes from within the kernel, and it runs its logging in a separate thread, so that it's really nice if you want to create fairly low impact logs of data from within the kernel. So you can dump straight to file, and that's extremely useful. So I do a lot of high speed packet manipulations. I've got a tool for pulling TCP state. When you're doing that for every packet, you want something that's not going to be too impactful. And ALQ is a really, really nice way for doing that. So instead of doing printf, for example, right, which really, really slows things to a grinding halt and can change very vastly what you're trying to measure, ALQ is much lower impact in that regard. Lock profiling, you can look at lock contention and whatnot. It's another very useful kernel option. Gives you a full like stat breakdown of how much time was spent, you know, and how many acquisitions and contentions happened and whatnot. The break to debugger and alt break to debugger are fairly useful. So if you're on the console and you have ability to, say, hit Control Alt Escape, that can drop you straight into the debugger just using the key presses instead of having to use some other more interesting options. And I think we turn it on by default now, so this is kind of a moot point, but obviously compiling with debug symbols is fairly important if you want to debug a kernel.
Make option -p for profiling, G-prof.
Ah, okay, that was a bit... someone told me you could do profiling, and I was looking around trying to figure out what the option was.
Fast mode and a slow mode. I never got the fast mode.
Okay, so you can add -p to the make options, and that adds the profiling support for G-prof. Okay, cool. Yeah, so that also obviously be shit. Yep.
One thing I have found very difficult is that the kernel is compiled with -02. And cause is very difficult to doing disassembling the kernel and on the running kernel. I was wondering if people have ran into that and do they do anything to work around it. I've tried, you know, inlines disappear, driver code.
Yeah, I don't know of a way around that other than turning off the O2, which obviously changes what you're trying to measure, so it's not an ideal situation, but I wave my hands vigorously at this point and defer to the to the other people in the audience. And perhaps we'll take that offline because I'm running out of time. I think I've got about 5 minutes to go, so I'll just quickly skip through this last bit. So the basic point is John had some nice slides from, I think, last year or the year before, so there's a link there which goes into more detail. But basically DDB is in kernel. It's really easy to extend and add more intricate and in-depth knowledge about data structures in the kernel and whatnot. So you can add DDB commands that have, you know, intimate knowledge of the variables they work on, can print them out nicely and whatnot, and you can write interesting scripts. The non-maskable interrupt is a way you can really easily put things into the debugger using IPMI, I believe. If you've got that support, you can install the tool and just tell it to generate an NMI, and that basically ends you up in the debugger, assuming you have the debugger installed into the compiled into the kernel with those previous options we were talking about. The alt break, the break to debugger options also, you know, if you're on the physical console and you can hit Control Alt Escape or whatever, that can, assuming you've got that support compiled in, that'll drop you into the DDB. You can actually cause a panic using assistctl. And the next thing is that if you're in DDB and then you want to be able to do things like get source listings and whatnot, which DDB doesn't know how to do because it doesn't pass the dwarf information, I believe, you can, and assuming you've got GDB support compiled into your kernel, you type GDB on the DDB command line, run step, and then that basically transfers control of the debugger over the serial port to the KGDB session that hopefully you've already started on the other end listening. So KGDB, that's a useful, that should have /tilde in front of it. There's a useful RC file for it. So in your home directory, there should be /.gdb in it. You can set things that you always want to happen whenever you start KGDB. So for example, setting the baud rate to 100,000 in there so you don't have to keep typing, remembering to type it is a useful thing, saving your fingers some work. GDB protocol serial, we talked about that. You can use KGDB to analyze crash dumps really easily, so you just pass in I'll cover that on the next slide. But anyway, so that line there, KGDB-R, is what you use to connect to a serial port on your machine, which is hopefully going to talk to the DDB on the other session after you've dropped it through to GDB. And it can do lots of nice things. And, yes?
Macros in KGDB init are a wonderful thing.
Yes, I've heard lots of good things about them. I've never used one, so...
I have probably 30 or 40 that can go through SCP associations and find things and look for things.
Okay. I'm gonna, I'll have to pick your brains about them later though, because I haven't used them personally, and I know that I'm probably missing out big time, and I see lots of vigorous nodding of heads. So it's macros are something that I will have to add at a later date. Crash dumps, very, very useful. Probably run into them a few times if you ever managed to panic your kernel, and if you had crash dump support on. On the head branch, it's on by default, I believe, but on the on any of the stable branches, you've got to actually enable auto crash dumps. So you set that in rc.conf, or you can manually enable them if you're interested using the dump on command. You just point it at your swap device, and that will that should take care of everything. If you actually drop into DDB, you can manually cause a crash dump by calling the do a dump function and then reset, and that will actually cause it to write out a crash dump. If you've got DDB enabled in your kernel, it'll drop to that first instead of writing a crash dump. So this is the process to actually cause it to dump core and reset, and then that should write it out to normally /var crash or whatever it is, and then you get a VM core in there that you can analyze offline using KGDB. So basically you pass it the kernel that core was related to that you were running at the time and the path to the core, and then you can do all the things you would do if you're doing online debugging, and it takes care of itself. A lot of useful tools can work on crash dumps. They can take the path to the core file as an argument, so you can do sort of offline analysis. Text dumps are a kind of somewhat or relatively new feature, and they basically, instead of providing a binary dump of all the memory, which is obviously gives you full access to everything that was going on, it gives you kind of a nice summary as a bloody big text file, but kind of useful for passing around and kind of easier for end users to be able to figure out and have a look at. So, and obviously there's lots of good information already in the developer's handbook about this and various other places as well. Profiling tools. HWPMC sounds like it's seriously cool. Haven't played with it, but I've seen what it can do, and it's very impressive. So that's getting access to the counters and the CPUs, and displaying that information. And with PMC Annotate, you can actually use the HWPMC information collected to annotate your source code and show you where cache misses are happening and where time is being spent, at a very sort of low level, so you can do fairly serious optimization work with it. We've got support for dtrace. Using dscripts, you can dynamically augment and switch on tracing and collection of information from the kernel, collect all sorts of various things. Stress testing, there's a regression test suite under the user source that's kind of a little bit higgledy-piggledy at the moment. It's not a unified, make test and everything gets run. I think there are a separate set of tools. Some of it's automated, some's not. There's a file system stress tool, which also, I believe, stresses the VM system and is fairly comprehensive in the things it covers, and that's used frequently, I see, in the commit logs to test all sorts of weird and wonderful changes to the kernel. Build world is an excellent test in its own right, particularly if you're on an SMP system and you crank up the -j, it can really get things going. And the thing I wanted to draw everyone's attention to regarding benchmarking is that it's really hard. And a lot of people don't do it well, and they kind of draw frivolous conclusions based on really inadequate information. So chances are that if you're not willing to put the work in, don't try and draw a longbow and make any real... But the key is to identify and characterize all sources of error, which can be extremely difficult to do. And then really developing an understanding of what are the things you're taking for granted or you're assuming to be true and actually testing that they are, and any assertions that you're making as well. There's the Ministat tool, which is kind of useful for representing information if you've got multiple trials and want to show, hopefully demonstrate some statistical significance to the runs you've been making or the data you've been collecting. That's a very useful little tool. And, of course, there's things like, and some of those papers provide much more interesting commentary on some of the pitfalls of doing benchmarking work, but bottom line is don't overstate things. You're likely to get yourself into trouble. All right, so I'm kind of keen to continue to collect this information, so if you've seen something that I got wrong, if you think it kind of missing important information like the macros and various other bits, please email me, come chat to me. I'll be around till tomorrow afternoon. I'd like to keep trying to put this all together and continue to improve the documentation a little bit so that we can kind of, as I said earlier, put it all in one place and hopefully give people a really good starting point that they don't have to spend significant amounts of time to figuring out how to do some of this stuff that, it's taken us quite individually a bit of time. We should put it in one place. Yeah. So can you? I missed the second half.
If there are any mail aliases that one can send a question out to, all the documentation fails, or if there are IRC channels that one should hang out at.
List.freebsd.org. The mailing lists are an excellent source of information. That's where I've gotten a lot of mine from. IRC channels are hit and miss, depending on time of day and whatnot. So I will try and summarize some of that in the paper. So as to the answer, where I'm collecting this information, at the moment it's in just a technical report that I'm working on, which I'm going to publish not privately, but I'll publish through my research center. But I would really like to kind of see it go further than that, I guess, somewhere more accessible and hung directly off the FreeBSD website somewhere. So the answer is it's I'm collating it on my laptop here, and in my subversion repository. So I will make these slides available, obviously. But I skipped a lot of the more gory detail in these slides just to give the high level and give people the sort of the pointers. Short answer is I'm not going to commit to a timeline to get this done. I'm pretty busy trying to finish this PhD, but. Expect it at some point, and feel free to bug me and send me emails and tell me to ask me for information, and that'll maybe prompt me to get around to it. So the mailing lists, the wiki. The wiki has a lot of really good information that's providing, proving to be a really nice place to store stuff. Time's up. Okay. Thank you to the FreeBSD Foundation. Thank you to all of you here. And thanks to Dan for helping me be here, because I couldn't be here without either of them. And that's it. Thank you. I'll see you around.